Not you. Please turn off all your cell phones, PDAs, anything that makes noise, because we have you make contributions to the Common School Fund if we hear those go off. If you'd like to testify, the sign-up sheets are on the side over there. Let me just give folks a heads up where we're going to go this morning so you, for your planning purposes. Apparently, we're not ready on Senate Bill 476, so we will not go into work session on that today. We are going to hear 624 first, then we're going to hear the two House bills, and then we're going to go into a quick work session on 417 and 23, and then we will hear Senate Bill 775 for the remainder of our time, which should be an hour or more. So I think that gives us plenty of time to work with. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 624. Ms. Richardson, tell us what's going on here, please.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 624 designates the designates the Bureau of Labor and Industries and chairpersons of the commission serve. Sorry, can I start over?
Sure. It's a do-over today.
A mulligan.
Let me make sure what I wrote makes sense. It designates that the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the chairpersons of the commission served by the Oregon Advocacy Commission Office will appoint and establish qualifications and salary for the Advocacy Commission Administrator. It specifies that the administrator will staff the Advocacy Commission and may receive administrative assistance from the Bureau. It rescinds the administrator authority to adopt rules for the Advocacy Commission. Did that make sense?
I think so. So we'll get started with Senator Richard Devlin, who is going to give us some even more information.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of Senate Bill 624. Senate Bill 624, as indicated, moves the Office of Advocacy Commissions from the Department of Administrative Services to the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Office of the Advocacy Commissions provides shared administrative support to the Commission on Asian Affairs, the Commission on Black Affairs, the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, and the Oregon Commission for Women. The move to the BOLI is consistent with the mission of the Office of Advocacy Commission and the missions of the four advocacy commissions. I submitted this bill after being requested by the Governor's Office to explore moving the Office of Advocacy Commissions from the Department of Administrative Services to a more appropriate state agency. Commissioner Gardner, who I believe either is here or representative is here on part of Commissioner Gardner, and the Governor's Office is supportive of this bill. Colleagues, the advocacy commissions have a long history in this state. The Women's Commission dates from 1983 under Governor Vicatia. It actually is even predated by a Governor's Commission on the Status of Women in 1964 under Governor Hatfield. The Commission on Black Affairs dates from 1980 under Governor Vicatia. The Commission on Hispanic Affairs dates from 1981 under Governor Vicatia, but it was actually predated also by the Commission on Chicano Affairs under Governor Tom McCall from 1971. The Asian Commission actually is fairly recent, 1995 under Governor Kitzhaber. However, since 2002, the advocacy commissions have faced a great number of challenges. As we went through some of the worst times in our budget history in recent times, they were all actually defunded in the 2002 special sessions. In 2003, they were given other funds appropriation, and for those of you, actually, everyone on the committee now has been on Ways and Means. Other funds appropriation in this particular circumstance means if you go out and raise the money, we will allow you to spend it. That's basically what it means. And in 2005, however, there was a successful effort to reorganize the commissions and provide the central support staff. That bill, SB 359, passed 25-4 in the Oregon Senate. SB 624 today would allow the Office of Advocacy Commissions to function properly and thus continue to allow the commissions to continue their advocacy work. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Any questions? Great testimony as usual. I think I'm going to call up the Commissioner, Dan Gardner, next to agree or disagree with you. Come on, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I am actually obviously very interested in this, but I have to actually get to my own committee.
Amazing.
So we have questions, don't we, Madam Chair?
All right. Thank you, Senator. We always appreciate hearing from you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I want to thank you very much for holding a hearing on Senate Bill 624. I'm very happy to appear today in support of the bill. If the bill were to pass, it would provide that the administrator of the Advocacy Commission be appointed by a board consisting of members of the Advocacy Commission and myself, and it also provide the advocacy commissions can utilize the administrative assistance of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I have to tell you, in all of the budget cuts, the Bureau of Labor and Industries has gone from about 1993, when we had 159 employees, to about 108 today. And when you look at our civil rights division, for instance, we're a complaint-driven agency. We've gone from being having an advocacy role in the communities through the Civil Rights Division to totally being complaint driven. I see this as a natural in working together with the commissions to help with their advocacy role and to help with outreach through the Civil Rights Division as well. One of the other divisions under the Bureau, of course, is the Apprenticeship and Training Division. And as I've talked to many about, we have great needs out there in apprenticeship. As we've got the greying of America and the baby boomer generation retiring, there's needs for more apprenticeship. And it's always the Bureau's goal to diversify those apprentices, to bring in more women and more minorities into apprenticeship and training. I can see, you know, our working with the advocacy commissions being helpful in attaining that goal through the Bureau as well. And so I think that it's a natural fit. I think we can work well together. I think the commissions would find a very welcome home with the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. They've been in flux for a number of years now. So if they can find a home in your department and be well taken care of, that would be great.
Well, Madam Chair, back in 2001 when I was on that side of the dais, mm-hmm. I can remember being on the Ways and Means Subcommittee. Their budget was in, and some of the flux that they were in and some of the strains put on them, and I'd be happy to be of assistance with that.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Commissioner, a pleasure to have you with us. Okay, I have four more people to testify. I usually do it in threes, but since there's four, we'll do it two by two. Anna Willman and Carol Suzuki are up next, and there's no one in opposition, so if you just want to give us a great little short testimony about how this is a good bill.
I have a statement here from all four commissions that I'd like to read. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay. Commissioners from the Oregon Advocacy Commission.
But you first have to tell us who you are.
Okay.
I know who you are, but nobody else does.
My name is Anna Willman, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Commission for Women.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioners from the Oregon Advocacy Commissions met on March 17, 2007, to consider the structure and location of the Office of Advocacy Commissions and the individual agency advocacy commissions. We considered a range of criteria and reached consensus on the following issues. One, the Office of Advocacy Commissions continues to serve a practical and strategic function by allowing administrative support to be shared among the four commissions while each commission works to fulfill its individual statutory mandates. A continued OAC maximizes resources, avoids duplication, and provides unique opportunities for collaboration on issues of common interest among the four commissions. Two, an administrative move from the Oregon Department of Administrative Services as a host agency to the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, BOLI, is most in line with the OAC's mission and current needs. A natural partnership exists between the advocacy commissions and BOLI's civil rights focus. In addition, the prospects for fiscal and administrative stability at BOLI will allow OAC the opportunity to reorganize and become more effective in carrying out its mission while supporting the missions of the individual commissions. the apparent political support for this move, including that of Boley Commissioner Dan Gardner and the Governor's Office, reinforces the strength of this partnership. And three, because of the lack of clarity of the relationship between the OAC administrator and the OAC host agency and the individual commissions, it is critical that legislation clarifies the role of the OAC administrator, and guarantees the individual commissions a voice in the hiring, supervision, and termination of staff. The autonomy and authority of the individual commissions to carry out advocacy work within and on behalf of their respective communities is clear from the existing statutory language governing each commission. It is imperative that the statutory language governing the OAC is reconciled. This has been a period of great challenge for the advocacy commissions, but we are hopeful that this legislative session will provide an opportunity for renewed strength and support. We are hopeful that the OAC will find a comfortable and supportive home at Boley, and that this will allow us to focus on our missions and move forward after years of struggling just to survive.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Willman. Can you provide a copy of that to the committee so we have it for our files? Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Ms. Suzuki.
Hello, Carol Suzuki, member of the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs, and I just wanted to just state for the record that during the interim we've had a number of meetings to bring us to this point, and the members of the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs are very supportive of this move.
Great. I love it when people include all the parties in the process. It works out much better for us. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two more people to testify, Francisca Johnson from my neck of the woods and Johnny Lake, who also hangs out in my neck of the woods. Come on up.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Francisca Johnson, and I am chair of the Commission for Hispanic Affairs, and very supportive of this. I have to tell you that we have been through some incredible challenges, bringing four commissions together that were so used to working apart and struggling as we have. We feel that our move to Boley just absolutely fits, as you know I do. Complaint work for the City of Eugene on our ordinance and stuff, and being under Boley will absolutely help us as we look at things throughout the state, you know, and being office closer to the Capitol. Right now where is Pringle? It's way out there. It's very hard to find, even when you've been there a couple of times. So the Hispanic Commission is very supportive of being a part of this new change, and the working relation that we now have is absolutely amazing. We don't want to be separated.
Great. Glad to hear that.
Good morning. I'm Johnny Lake, Chair of the Commission on Black Affairs. Madam Chair and other legislators, thank you all for the opportunity to visit with you for a minute. This conversation is about voice, and voice of people in a democracy is critical. Three of our governors did a fantastic editorial a few years ago, and they identified these commissions as the only official voice of communities of women and minorities in the state, and that's why this conversation is so important, because the commissions represent access and voice for communities that have traditionally not had a lot. And so we can talk about commissions, and I think there's criticisms on both sides about the commissions, but their facility in the future of Oregon as a state, and as a state that values this diversity and recognizes this diversity and utilizes this diversity, is critical. We have small but vital minority communities that operate in this state, and they will only continue to grow. And I can tell you from working in our schools that we have incredibly diverse little communities of people who are growing up together in our schools. And I see the commissions, and especially with good working relationships with the rest of Oregon government and the rest of the Oregon community, being vital inlets for developing the incredible potential that our community holds. We will raise world-class citizens right here in Oregon, which people see Oregon as not very diverse, but I work with little children who are speaking two languages, three languages, four languages. I can show you one girl in our elementary schools who speaks five languages. and she's only fifth grade. And so the access that our children are having to the different cultures pose a very bright future for our Oregon, and I think the commissions will play an incredibly important role. So the relationship with Boley is an excellent one. We've had an excellent relationship with Boley for years. I've been, I think I'm senior person on these commissions, but we've gone through the state police. We've been at Department of Corrections. We've gone from agency to agency trying to find a place that we can actually collaborate well with another agency. And Boley has been a wonderful ally and a support for us. So I would support fully being underneath Boley.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? I think we're all in sync with you here. We're very happy that this has come together. Thank you both for coming up and testifying. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 624 and entertain a motion from Senator Metzger.
I move Senate Bill 624 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 624 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, concerns? Okay. Hearing none, go ahead. Ms. Gravel.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Senator Weston.
Aye.
Excuse? Aye. Senate Bill 624 passes, and Senator Westland, you haven't carried one for a while. It's all yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Close the work session on Senate Bill 624. And next, we're going to is Senator Representative Lim. I do that all the time. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on HJR 12A and HB 2447A. Come on up, Representative.
Madam Chair, HJR 12A encourages Oregon citizens and organizations to join the celebration of Korean American Day. HB 2447A establishes January 13th as Korean American Day and establishes Korean American Day Commission to operate until January 2nd, 2016.
Great, thank you. And we are graced with the presence of Representative John Lim.
Thank you very much. May I call the Herb Fletcher? My
absolutely, call whoever you wish.
Okay, and then Herb, and is over here? Oh, please, yes. And also the Sam Guang.
No.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I'm glad to see you here from time to time, and especially I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for having a public hearing and possible work session on HJR 12 and also House Bill 2447. Simply HJR 12, simply it says that January 13 is the day of the Korean American Day. This bill, this resolution, similar resolution, passed by the U.S. Congress, both House and Senate, in 2005. Already three other states, like Virginia, California, and Georgia, already passed this bill. And Washington State and Oregon State, we are simultaneously working on the similar bill. And then Koreans, a very important part in the state of Oregon. We have about 25,000 Korean Americans living in here. Maybe half of them are first generation Korean American like I am. Maybe half of them are born here. And they usually own the small mom and pop grocery stores, and then dry cleaners, and the restaurant insurance. Now, one and a half and second generation, they are going into the mainstream in America, becoming the doctors and lawyers and the teachers, very strongly believing in education. And so this urging our government that declare January 13 is a Korean American Day. That's what the HJR 12 is about. And if I may also, I'd like to say a few words about the House Bill 2447. 2447, when if and when it's passed HJR 12, then there should be a group of people in charge of celebrating of this Korean American Day. Out of that concern, I have introduced House Bill 2447, simply the governor appointing 9 commissioners, and then they are going to in charge and organizing this celebration, and there's no tax dollars involved there at all, and then they are not getting any per diem at all. So as far as that the money is concerned, not a cent is involved. Only they are in charge of organizing, coordinating of the celebration, and then this House Bill 2447, some said 2016. By that time, they shall be able to organize Korean American themselves, and then we don't need at the time, hopefully, not any commissioners because it's already organized, ready to go. So this is not any permanent that the government entity. Only by the initiation, 9 commissioners appointed by the governor, and they are going to be in charge of this organization for celebration. With that, and then I'm going to pass over to my good friend of Fletcher. And then hopefully next Sam Gua, we could bring many that the people to testify. Since the time is limited, I only requested them hopefully just 2 minutes each.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
And I'm sure you have the copy of a testimony from the Korean Consul General Tom Walsh.
Okay.
He was not able to come here, but he sent the.
We do have that.
Yes, you do have that copy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Fletcher, good to see you.
Chair Walker and members of the Senate Education and General Government Committee. I'm Irv Fletcher, live at 1272 Mayana Drive, Woodburn, Oregon. I'm appearing today here representing myself and also, by the way, the Korean War Veterans Association Oregon Trail Chapter. That wasn't in my testimony, but they weren't able to make it, so I'm also speaking on their behalf. As I understand the intent of 2447, if enacted in its present form, it would declare January 13th of each year as Korean-American Day, and it would also establish a Korean-American Commission to promote, organize, and coordinate Korean-American celebrations. I was privileged to have served in the United States Navy from September 1950 until July 17, 1954. A portion of my enlistment was served on board the USS Corregidor, CVE 58. Which transported jet aircraft to the war zone for use in air action over the Korean Peninsula. I'll omit the next two pieces because I'm running close to 2 minutes. I would be remiss if I did not salute Representative John Lim for his outstanding service in the Oregon Legislative Assembly and to the greater Oregon community. He is living proof of the contributions of the Korean Americans have made to this community, the state of Oregon, and the United States, and I salute him. Thank you, and I hope you pass both HB 2447 and HJ.
HJ 19.
House Resolution 12.
Okay.
There you go. Thank you, Mr. Fletcher, and thank you for your service to our country.
If I may say that, Madam Chair, Sam Gua. He's a pillar of the Korean-American community. Also, he served in the past as the chair of Commission on Asian Affairs.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's my honor to be here to speak for this occasion. Actually, I've been living in Portland metropolitan area for the past over 30 years. I came in 1972 as a student to go to a graduate school at Portland State. Since then, I became a member of the Oregonian, actually. During 1970s, 80s, 90s, immigration, opportunities opened, and many Koreans came not only to the United States, but also this part of the nation. And so right now we have about over 25,000 Korean Americans living in the state of Oregon. Many of us came initially with almost a bare hand, including, I know, the representative John Lim, and myself, and many others too. But we came here with a purpose. The purpose was for better life for ourselves and also better life for our children. With that purpose, has led us to overcome any obstacles, any difficulties in new environment, and also in achieving our goals and our purpose. So that's why now we Korean Americans, no matter where you go, pretty much settle down and very well to do and very constructive and to our society right now. And that's why also 7 years ago, when there was a call for help to build the Korean War Memorial in Wilsonville, all Korean community, including St. John Lim, we all got together who helped it. So today, I came here in support House Bill 2447 and House Joint Resolution 12, designating January 13 as a Korean American Day and also establishing Korean American Day Commission. And the passage of this bill and resolution will be a great honor to all Korean Americans, and not only in our state and in our country, which is USA, and also our homeland, Republic of Korea. And also this passage will be considered as a great recognition of our contribution to our state and our country here. So, and then thus, as a result, making all of us more productive force in promoting growth of this society. So it's going to be a great event if you pass this test. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I know I can speak on behalf of this committee and this entire assembly when I thank you for the Korean community's contribution and sharing of your culture with our country and now your country. We are a diverse state, and we just so appreciate having you here and honoring your culture and your values. So thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
And Mr. Fletcher, you've got your hand
up. One additional and last comment, I promised. When we were constructing the Korean War Memorial in Wilsonville, a project of several hundred thousand dollars, Senator Lim must have put a call into the Prime Minister of South Korea, a friend of mine. I went there, a Korean War veteran, that came back with a check for $100,000.
Oh, my.
Thank you very much.
I don't know what the language was, John.
It is not us, Madam Chair. It is came from the Hynix company. They donated $100,000 in building the Korean War Memorial. We appreciate them. We were just acting as a mediator.
Great. Well, I appreciate that, given that Hynix is in my community.
Just one more minute. And this HJR 12 and House Bill 2447 passed out of the House unanimously and with a strong endorsement. And also, I'm working with the Washington State. Hopefully, we pass this bill simultaneously and celebrate at the same time, because many other leaders of the Korean American leaders came to our state and Washington to celebrate the passage of this bill.
Well, great. I hope we can accommodate everyone. Any questions from the committee? Senator Westland.
Just a question. I can answer Irv's question about what language it was. It was the language of love and respect.
Thank you very much.
Great. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. It causes me to reflect on a period of my life that was significantly influenced by a young man that landed on the shores of the United States, a Korean War refugee, who went on to earn 3 doctorates, and a noted anthropologist, historian, Dr. Sung Mae Rhee. And he was an influential person in my life, in my educational background. So these are good memories, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming and testifying today.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Really appreciate it. That is all the testimony we have signed up, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill, HGR 12A and HB 2447A, and open a work session on, let's take one at a time, HJR 12A. Senator Metzger.
Madam Chair, I move HJR 12A be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great. Be adopted, I think.
Adopted.
Be adopted. Okay. Senator Metzger moves that HJR 12A be adopted and moved to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, questions? Okay, Ms. Gravel, I'd like to give her a voice, every committee.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westland?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crew?
Excused.
Chair Walker?
Aye. The resolution is adopted, and Senator Morris, I'm going to assign this to you and the other one as well, so you can honor your friend.
I would be delighted to do that.
Good.
Madam Chair.
We'll open a work session on HB 2447A.
I move House Bill 2447A. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great. Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2447A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further comments? Okay. Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Westman?
Aye.
Excuse?
Chair Walker?
Aye. So ordered, and Senator Morris will carry that as well. Okay, terrific. All right, we're going to go into work session on Senate Bill 417. Ms. Ledwig, can you come up while Ms. Richardson explains the amendments, and then you can walk us through these?
Madam Chair, the Senate Bill 417 abolishes the Lane County Boundary Commission, transfers funds, rights, and obligations of the Lane County Boundary Commission to Lane County. It abolishes the Lane County Local Government Boundary Commission Fund. The committee has before them dash 2 and dash 3 amendments. I apologize for not writing up the dash 3 amendments. They came in early this morning. The dash 2 amendments provides for the distribution of abolished commission monies according to rates charged as assessed and collected from the entities within the abolished commission jurisdiction. It authorizes Lane County to assess and collect charges from said entities if there are insufficient funds to meet the transferred liabilities or obligations. It specifies that existing actions or proceedings against the defunct commission continue with the appropriate substitution of parties. It provides for distribution of the disbanded commission records and property. It requires boundary changes after January 2nd, 2008 to be processed under statutes for entities that do not have boundary commissions. That is the dash 2 amendments. The dash 3 amendments, I can tell you, are the same as the dash 2 amendments. However, the property would not go to the state archives. Instead, the commission could dispose of the property and either transfer the property or the proceeds of those property to Lane County. This bill currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, great. So we are not going to be entertaining the dash 2 because we discovered a little problem quickly yesterday, and Mr. Seabury, if you're listening on the internet, it is a very technical fix, and I'll have Ms. Ledwig explain it to us, and I want to thank Ms. Ledwig for her incredible work, as well as all the other work group members. We met a couple of times, but she was very instrumental in helping us get this just right, because if we don't do it right, we're in a mess. So, Ms. Ledwig?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. And just do want to thank the chair for getting the work group together. The work group was comprised of members of the cities of Lane County representatives, some citizens from Lane County, several of our good House representatives, myself, someone from the city of Eugene, and some communication with a representative from the Boundary Commission. And it was a very, very good process. It's largely a technical bill, but the amendments were designed to achieve two goals. One, to ensure that upon abolishment of the Lane County Boundary Commission, annexations are initiated and carried out by all 12 cities in Lane County. And the second goal was to provide the Lane County Boundary Commission some timelines and guidelines as to how they shut down and transfer their records and their caseload. So all of the amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, were predicated with that intention. The Dash 3 contained an amendment to Section 2, which, as you heard, deletes the words "and property" there. Apparently, we found out late yesterday that the state archivist does store records, that they don't store extra property. So we took out that language and substituted the any existing property that's left over later in the bill would be transferred to Lane County.
And Ms. Ludwig, it's my understanding the Boundary Commission just leases any property and they don't really have much of value at all. Is that correct?
And that is also my understanding, Madam Chair.
Okay.
The others, would you like me to walk through the other sections of the amendments?
Would the committee entertain that, or do you need it?
I think we're fine.
I think they're fine. We're the only Boundary Commission left, and it's a little bit dry area of the law, but we did make our record here this morning, our intent. I believe that's what we were trying to do here. And we did have tremendous participation. I do, Ms. Ludwig, I want to state for the record that we do continue to have an objection from Hazeldale Rural Fire Protection District from Oak Ridge, who's adamantly opposed to abolition of the Boundary Commission. But, colleagues, I would tell you that every city within Lane County wants to dissolve this commission because they see it as another layer of government and bureaucracy that just isn't needed anymore. Would that be correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct, Madam Chair. There is one more clarification on the amendments that I'd like to make for legislative intent. In Section 7, the amendment says, on or after January 2, 2008, a boundary changed as defined in ORS 199-415 must be processed and provided in the appropriate provisions of ORS Chapters 195, 198, 221, or 222. The intention there is that after January 1, boundary change applications will go to the appropriate city for boundary changes in city, that city in annexation, or to Lane County for any special district boundary changes. This time, because the Boundary Commission won't go away until July 1st of 2008, will allow the Boundary Commission to work through any applications they receive as of December 31st, 2007, and also provide them time to follow up and transfer the records and get all the recordings initiated and finished up the last 30 to 60 days of the Boundary Commission's life. So again, in Section 7, the intention there is for after January 1st, cities to process annexation applications and Lane County to process any special district boundary changes, which they do in Chapters 195, 198, 221, or 222. The Boundary Commission chapters are operative are in Chapter 199 of Oregon Revised Statutes.
Great. Thank you very much. This has been a tedious process, colleagues, as you can imagine, and we are thankful for it. My community is thankful for it. Many members of my constituency are extremely thankful for it. Any questions from the committee?
Did you say Hazeldale Rural Fire?
Yes, Hazeldale Rural Fire Protection District in Oak Ridge.
Oh.
They are not thankful for it, but they've been outnumbered.
I might have to reconsider this.
Uh-huh. Yep, I got a gavel in my hand. All right.
And she swacked my fingers with many times.
Yeah. Ms. Ludwig, thank you again very much. I really appreciate it. So we are in work session. And, also, there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but if you did notice your fiscal, it does indicate that the bill currently has a subsequent referral, but given that the bill would create a minimal fiscal impact on state government, the Legislative Fiscal Office does not need to have this bill come to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to complete the budget process. So that has been rescinded. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 417.
Senator Metzger moves the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 417. Any discussion? Any comments? Okay. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 417 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Great. Senator Metzger moves that Senate Bill 417 as amended be moved to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Whew. That's almost like reciting your marriage vows over again.
Before rescission comes in the divorce.
Yeah. You know, we're not going there.
After 32 years, I'm not about to chuck that. Any comments or questions? Okay. Ms. Gravel, you want to take the roll?
Aye.
Senator
Moore? Aye.
Senator Wester?
Aye.
Excuse.
Chair Walker.
Aye. So Senate Bill 417 will move to the floor. See how large this file is, colleagues. I'll carry this.
We've been hearing this for a long time, Madam.
No, yeah,
my file is almost as big as yours.
Yeah. No, I've been hearing it longer than you. But
that's true.
All right. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 417. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 23.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 23 expands the definition of eligible students for participation in the expanded options program. It changes program notification requirements. It provides the process for determining duplicate courses and appealing those determinations. It directs the school district and eligible post-secondary institutions to negotiate in good faith a financial agreement for payment of student instructional costs. It allows charter schools to participate in the expanded options program. It allows school districts to request waiver of requirements of participation in the program, declares an emergency, and take effect July 1st, 2007. We have dash ones and dash twos as well.
Great. Thank you. And we are in work session. Colleagues, there was a corresponding bill. I believe it was 622. And I've spoken with Senator Gordley, and she's agreed that we will be going forward with Senate Bill 23. She still has a slight objection about the waiver issue, but she's not going to stand in the way of this bill. She loves the concept of what we've done with expanded options. The Dash 2 amendment I'm not going to entertain unless someone wants to offer them up, simply because it would add the not-for-profit institutions, and as we mentioned last session, we have to take baby steps with this program, and you know, we're happy to look at it again, but this program has just gotten off the ground, and quite frankly it hasn't been had enough time to work with districts to get enough participation, and I'm just very hesitant about mucking it up at this point. So any comments?
I might be in the minority, Madam Chair. I would be willing to offer up the Dash 2s, having been involved in the trusteeship role in private higher ed. I think it's a reasonable thing to include, but that would be my
This was a very tenuous coalition that agreed to Senate Bill 300 last session, and it there were some real issues with that. And I'd like Ms. Wimmer Whalen from the coalition to come up and address this particular issue, if she would.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. And our objection to the Dash 2s as in the original proposal for four sessions regarding private schools getting public dollars is in part due to the fact that our attorney advises us that it's probably unconstitutional, and there's also a policy objection from our organization with respect to the use of those dollars for private programs. And so in the long negotiations over this bill, we had any number of give and takes over the years, and this was one of the pieces that we prevailed on, and we would certainly like to keep it that way.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Westland?
Our attorney, was it AG,
Senator
LC?
It was Margaret Olney, our attorney for the Oregon Education Association. And I did submit her constitutional argument to the chair for the record.
Yes, if anyone would like to see that, I have that here in my file. Any further comments?
Well, I do have a question.
Yes.
If we're talking about higher ed institutions and not-for-profit, right? So you're talking about Willamette University, right? It's not-for-profit? Is that what you...
Madam Chair and Senator Metzger, we're talking about private institutions that may be either independent or religiously affiliated. It's particularly the concerns about the religiously affiliated. She attached and to her legal opinion, for example, this has been a couple years ago now, but if memory serves, actual pages out of the catalogs of some of those organizations. And if I know where you're going with your question, you're probably thinking about the opportunity grants that go to private schools.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
you are. You agree with my mind.
Thank
I will
you.
Tell
we
you.
invite Lewis and Clark and Willamette all the time.
That's
for
right.
opportunity
well,
grants.
As a matter of fact, that has never been challenged. And there are attorneys in the state who believe that were it ever challenged, that it might not withstand scrutiny.
Okay. Well, I just kind of want to get that part on the record because mm-hmm. I don't want to, because we participate with a lot of not-for-profits. We had discussions yesterday on health care issues and, you know, on things that are not-for-profits. I mean, there's a lot of money, whether, you know, state or federal Medicaid dollars that go for not-for-profits and money that goes through it. And I just don't want to, you know, just have it go without commenting that prima facie that we don't use dollars for those who are not necessarily engaged simply in public established institutions.
Okay. I might comment the case that Ms. Wimmer Whalen is speaking of, the seminal case interpreting Article 1, Section 5 as Dickman versus School District Number 62C, and that case is from 1961, and cert was denied on that, but the statute at issue in Dickman required public school districts to provide textbooks for all children who live in the district. Under the statute, the defendant school district provided approximately $4,000 worth of textbooks to St. John's, a parochial school run by the Catholic Church. The court found that the church's purpose in running St. John's was to permeate the students' education with Catholic precepts, and the Oregon Supreme Court held that the use of public funds to provide textbooks to St. John's School violated Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution. The court acknowledged that the U.S. Supreme Court would reach a different conclusion under the federal Constitution. Nevertheless, the court stated that it had an obligation to independently analyze the statute under the Oregon Constitution, and in doing so, it reached a result different from that under the analogous federal provision. So under Dickman, the bill that they were referencing way back then was unconstitutional because the statutes struck down those provisions.
And that dealt with K-12?
That dealt with K-12, that particular case. But that would be also true in institutions of higher learning, I would assume, because they're also public institutions and they come under Article 1. There is another case, State versus Henry, in 1987, State versus Kennedy, and Hewitt versus Safe. And actually several cases here. So I can make copies of this if you'd like. But the reason for the statute and the Constitution, the reason for Article 1 and the Constitution was clear. So I don't know why we offer opportunity grants to those colleges, and if someone wants to challenge it, that's fine. But in this case, we sort of want to stay within the Constitution.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One size doesn't necessarily fit all, or one descriptor doesn't necessarily fit all institutions of, you know, that are private. You have faith-based institutions that are accredited and have you know, very, very fine programs, liberal arts programs that offer the exact same instruction that a public university or college would do. It's not this committee's jurisdiction, certainly, to set a new groundbreaking mm-hmm. constitutional law, but there's been a longstanding precedence to provide public assistance to students that go to private institutions that are in fact faith-based from a federal perspective and also from a state perspective.
Well, Senator, I appreciate that view, but in this particular case, let me read from the memo again. The inclusion of Western Baptist College in this particular formula demonstrates one of the bill's major constitutional flaws. And this, we're talking about a bill from another session. Attached is a copy of several pages from Western Baptist College's website. The college states that its mission is to educate Christians. It describes itself as a Christian college and states that it exists to provide an educational program specifically for Christians. The college's webpage elaborates, We provide a Christian atmosphere on campus by requiring all students and employees who have made a personal profession of faith in Jesus Christ. That, the court has determined, is a violation of Article 1 if we were to give them public money. Because it goes on, since all of our faculty, staff, and students are Christians, all of the courses are taught from the Christian point of view, thus integrating biblical principles in every program. It's clearly a faith-based program and would clearly violate Article 1. Wow. So, but not all of our not-for-profit institutions are faith-based, as you're pointing out.
Yeah, as I say, I just want to point out, Madam Chair, that in the argument that you're reading, it's discussing another conflict with, you know, with private established religion and state, and which drifts further away from just someone that's not-for-profit. I mean, there's a number of issues that was dealing with that weren't necessarily germane to just being not-for-profit. Besides, we could get really nervous about this because I think we're sitting on property of Willamette University that was given for the purposes of the cap. They might take it back.
I don't think they can.
But we digress.
Yeah, we do. So, anyway, that's sort of my thought, unless you can break out the religious institutions from the non-religious. I don't think you can even go there. And there was a lot of discussion, was there not, Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, on this issue. And this bill took 8 years to pass.
Yes, Madam Chair, and our agreement to help support the passage of that bill in 2005 was predicated on this issue being resolved the way it was resolved, and we'd sure hate to see that backslide. It would feel like a betrayal.
And our agreement means whom is covered in the our?
Madam Chair, the agreement was among a large coalition of folks who had different and varied interests in the bill, including folks from the higher ed system, from community colleges, all the K-12 advocates. We had a coalition of interested parties that was very far-flung, everyone from the ACLU at some points in the various stages of the bill to American Jewish Federation to other civil rights groups and, as I said, all of the education stakeholders in post-secondary and K-12. So there were a number of folks. Oh, and also the business community. Harvey Matthews represented the Associated Oregon Industries and kind of led the coalition effort to the agreement that we came to in 2005. And as you may remember from my original testimony on Senate Bill 23, the bill before you with the Dash 1 amendments added represents that coalition's coming back together during the interim before this session to fix elements of the agreement that didn't get drafted quite as we had planned in 05, and so we wanted to fix those, and also in the interim we had learned of new issues related to timeline challenges and a few other things that required clarification, and the coalition brought all of that to this committee with the hope that we could fix the law with respect to our original agreement and these new pieces.
And thank you for that. And so, colleagues, that sort of lays it out why I'm a little bit nervous about making any additional change at this point in time. I would say that you might ask for, in the interim, because I hope we don't go there now, but in the interim, I would have an opinion from Legislative Council whether we can differentiate in the not-for-profit colleges whether they're faith-based or not, and then make an effort to add them to the bill. But last session, I wouldn't add the tag stuff to this bill because we just couldn't go there. It was too big of a thing to bite off at this point because this is an impact, financial impact to districts and the state school fund. And so they were a little bit nervous about moving forward, and it was a very tenuous discussion, and it lasted quite some time last legislative session. So I really would like to just fix the problems that we have and then improve or vary the bill next session if you so choose.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1.
All right. Thank you. Senator Metzger moves the Dash 1 to Senate Bill 23. Any further discussion on that? Any objection? Okay, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 23 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 23 as amended to the floor of the Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion, colleagues? We've had a good discussion, actually. Okay, Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Westheim?
Aye.
Vice Chair Peterson?
A Excused. Aye. Senate Bill 23 passes to the floor, and I will carry that. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 23. We're not hearing Senate Bill 476, so now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 775. We've got an hour and 5 minutes. We're ahead of schedule. Ms. Richardson, what's going on here?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 775 establishes the Oregon Governance Council, specifies membership and duties, and establishes the Oregon Governance Council account. It requires reports to the legislature. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we have a dash one before. Shall I speak to that?
Yes, please.
The dash one amendment declares an emergency, indicating that the bill would take effect upon passage.
Okay, terrific. And we have some folks scheduled to testify. If I can find my little cheat sheet, who wanted to go first? There it is. Linda Modrell and Leslie Lewis.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee, and particular greetings to Senator Morris, who represents portions of Benton County. We're very proud of him. Thank you for your work. For the record, I'm Linda Madrell, Benton County Commissioner and Second Vice President of the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 775, which will establish the Oregon Governance Council. Leslie Lewis and Laura Pryor are here today also to testify about the importance of the Governance Council, its history, and how this council could operate. I will begin with the basics, what this bill does, and why it is of critical importance now. To answer what is often the bottom line question first, we're not asking for money. This is not a Ways and Means bill. AOC does offer to staff this council, should it be the pleasure of this committee to move this bill on. The Governance Council would be composed of 13 members. One would be appointed by the governor, and six would come from the legislature. There would be two elected officials, each from the counties in the cities, and the special districts and metro would have representation. They were asked to testify today, but their schedules just did not permit them to be here today. County government delivers many shared services as a partner of state government. In that partnership, services are funded by shared revenue streams, state funds, and county property taxes. Through our fiscal and programmatic partnership, we ensure that our people, Oregonians, receive needed services. Our interconnected systems of services are critical to the success of serving our constituents at both the local and the state levels. These services include public health, mental health, community corrections, juvenile services, criminal prosecution, elections, assessment and taxation, county fairs, and on and on. The members of the proposed Governance Council would come together to address potential, pending, and past system failures and strive to avoid future unintended consequences. The Council is not an advocacy avenue for your partners. It is a tool to solve significant problems in our systems of services. We, you and I and others here in the room, are servants to the people and stewards of the money they contribute to our communities, and we can do better. The current significant issue is the loss of the forest safety net, which affects nearly every county and for some is an unmitigated disaster. This was not unexpected, but despite many attempts to manage the loss of funds, the dismantling of service systems is imminent, and the situation puts the real problem of a failing financial system for government services in stark relief. Whether or not the forest payments are reauthorized, it will be a short-lived solution. and one that will not be at the same level of funding that we have experienced in the past. We will have to come together in some fashion to address the system's failures that will happen in law enforcement, transportation, and public health, to just name a few. This is about strengthening and improving our mutual interests in serving the people of Oregon the best that we possibly can, and we can do better. I'll just move this over to Leslie. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Walker, committee members, for the record, I'm Leslie Lewis. I'm a county commissioner from Yamhill County, and I am chair of the Governance Steering Committee at the Association of Oregon Counties. Senate Bill 775 is a priority for the Association of Oregon Counties, and Commissioner Madrell has just spoken about one of the major reasons why we believe that this bill is reaches almost an emergency status this session, and that's why we are asking for the emergency clause. And that is because of the loss of the forest safety net payments. You may have heard recently that through the good work of Senator Wyden and our congressional delegation, Senator Smith, you know, we may get some of those dollars restored. We don't know, though. And the president is threatening a veto. It is unclear what is going to happen with those forest safety net payments. And even if they are restored by the formula that Senator Wyden has worked out in his amendment, they gradually decrease over the next 5 years. Thankfully, if we do get a five-year reauthorization, it will give us time as partners, as your partners, to work on solutions for how we restore or come up with revenues to keep some of these counties going. Because if we go down to 40% of what we get now for some counties, that will be loss of somewhere near 40% of their general fund. As you may know, I had the opportunity to serve here in the legislature in the 90s. I've been involved with local government on my planning commission in the county, and now I serve as a county commissioner. So for the last 17 years, I've been very involved with government in Oregon at both the state and the local level. And over that time, I've seen many instances where the Governance Council would have served as well. It would have been a standing committee, in essence, where the state and the local partners could work together on some of the issues that we have had to deal with in the last 17 years. Measure 5 comes to mind, Measure 11, Senate Bill 1145, Measure 50. And it would have been a great benefit to the state and your local partners to have something like the Governance Council in place. Just to give you an example of the reason why we are all in partnership and why this bill contains cities, special districts, counties, and the state, let's just talk about the loss of the forest safety net and what that does to transportation. County road departments statewide will lose 20% of their revenue with the loss of the federal dollars. So that just sounds like, well, maybe that's just a county issue. But oftentimes, as a county, I will tell you, we share some of those revenues with the cities because we have projects that we do jointly together. We also use those dollars as matching dollars for state projects, and you know that the Oregon Department of Transportation is constantly asking local government to provide matching dollars for state highway projects. So the loss of these federal forest dollars will not affect only the counties. It will affect our city partners. It will affect our state partners. That's just one example. We could talk about Measure 50 and the effect that that had on special districts, school districts, cities, counties, and the state, of course. And in coming up with a resolution to the forest safety net issues that counties deal with, we're going to have to look at revenues and the way we garner revenues at the local level. And you can't look at that without that affecting the state. Anything you do with the property tax system could force us into compression, which would affect all of our partners in the property tax system. So
we really need this governance council for the specific issue that we are dealing with today, the Forest Safety Net. But I think the council can be of benefit to us going forward in the future for all of the issues that the state might face and that we might face with you as your local government partners. So we are asking for an emergency clause. That's the dash one amendments. And we believe there may be some other amendments that need to be offered for this. We have discovered that when legislative council put this together in section two, we have the members of the council serving four-year terms. And since some of the members come out of the House, we'll have to address that since you can't be guaranteed that a legislator from the House will serve more than a two-year term. So that will have to be amended. I think we also have some of our partners from labor who want to speak to the bill, and that may we may need some additional amendments because of what the issues that they raise. But we look forward to working with you. We think that that we all need to sit at the same table and work together on these issues for the benefit of all of our constituents who are the people of Oregon, and we know that you enjoy serving them and we enjoy serving them as well, and we all want to provide the best service possible for those citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both. And Ms. Lewis, thank you for your service to the Legislative Assembly and your continued service. And I see we have former Representative Gary Hansen in the audience as well. And always appreciate seeing members again.
Thank you.
I have questions, but I'll open it up to the committee first and see if you all have some. Okay. Then I'll start out, if I could. I've had some comments. My county commission is not all members are on board with this idea. Let me ask you this. Is this group going to replace Association of Oregon Counties or be another layer? I mean, I don't. I guess the question is, why do we need more bureaucracy in another layer of government?
Well, I don't think we see this as another layer of government at all. And as we mentioned earlier, as Commissioner Madrell mentioned, the AOC is willing to staff this committee. I think this is an opportunity for us to bring members of these different government entities together in a standing committee where we can discuss issues as they come up. For example, I'll just give some issues from Measure 50. You know, I was here in the legislature and served on House Revenue when we wrote Measure 50 in 1997. And while it was a vast improvement over Measure 47, we frankly, you know, made a number of errors when we wrote Measure 50. Had we had the ability to work more closely with our local government partners, I think that we would have had an opportunity perhaps to have not had some of those unintended consequences. Michelle Hawkins from Linn County is sitting behind me. She's the county treasurer there, and she can tell you that we made a huge error when it came to Linn County and to Deschutes County, Senator Westland. It's that kind of the hope that we could do a better job to working together as partners with everyone sitting at the table. Again, when you discuss property taxes, you have to have the special districts there. You have to have Metro there. You have to have cities and counties and the state there because it affects all of us. So that's just one example. But again, dealing with the Forest Safety Net, we have many, you know, many issues where the partners need to be discussing this.
Mm-hmm. What? I guess I need to continue on that theme because we do work groups all the time. Yesterday I introduced a new concept to both chambers for corporate tax accountability, and that's going to need a lot of discussion. So I'm in the process of now putting together my work group that's going to include the counties and the cities and all of those people who are impacted, and so we're all going to be at the table, but I don't need a governance council to do that. And that's some of the pushback that I'm getting out there outside the building.
Go ahead.
So does your governance council just deal with one system?
Well,
they do all kind of interconnect. So it's when you get and of course we have all of these issues that do one, what happens in one area does maybe affect another area, and maybe you don't realize it because the person who, or the group who would have an interest in this unintended consequence just isn't even there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, that happens a lot. And then you get sandbagged in the end when you think you've covered all your bases.
Yeah. Well, and Senator, Section 4 is very important in this bill because we deliberately have in here that the council needs to make a report back to the entire Legislative Assembly at every session. And the reason for that is exactly what you're pointing out. You have a work group, and you as the chair and a few other legislators who are involved in that work group are quite aware. But there's 90 people in this building, mm-hmm. and you know maybe you have half a dozen legislators involved in your work group. The other 84 don't have the same level of understanding, and that's why having the report back from the Governance Council, and of course we also envision that the Governance Council itself will have to draw and have subcommittees and draw other people into the discussions, of course that's going to be necessary, but I think the reporting back to the whole Legislative Assembly gives us an opportunity to make sure that everyone is well informed about these issues.
Okay, let me ask another question then, if I might, because the Governance Council consists of 13 members. Did you have discussions with these members? I'm not going to go over the legislature, but you've got elected county officials, so AOC, city officials, so League of Oregon Cities, special districts, and someone from a metropolitan service organization or service district. So did you have discussion with all of them? I think in your earlier testimony you said Metro was going to be here but couldn't. But what about the cities and the special districts of those folks? And what about labor and environmental people? Have you talked to all those folks before you came forward?
Well, I can say that a couple of years ago, maybe earlier when this first started, we just had counties in here. Because we are sort of the partner with the largest connection to you all. But the cities wanted representation at the time. They special districts wanted representation and so on. I think the labor issue has just recently come up. And I know that Judge Pryor is here to also testify.
Okay.
So she could maybe address some of those issues.
And I did want to mention,
actually, Judge Pryor, why don't you just come up, because you're the only other person.
Tucker from Metro was here earlier.
Yeah, he's in the back of the room.
Oh, is he still here? Okay.
He's gone now.
And he and I did have a chance.
He made a quick exit.
He and I did have a chance to speak, and he said that I was free to tell you that Metro definitely wants a seat on the council. So, but he didn't feel like he could add much other than that, but that they do want a seat on the council.
Okay. So, Judge Pryor, welcome. Yes, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I have been for 20 years a Gillum County judge. I'm just retired, and I live at 17062 Highway 206 in Condon.
Welcome to retirement.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wish I could be in your shoes, but
maybe not.
I don't know. I guess it's this vision of mine that when I retire, I'll have all the time to do all the things that I never had time to do. But is that true? Have you been in retirement long enough to answer
December
that question?
December 31st, and the answer is no.
Yeah, it hasn't been long enough then.
I can tell you that's not true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, great. Well, what do you think about this bill, Ms. Pryor?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the reason that I'm here is because in 2001, the president of the Oregon Senate, Gene Durfler, and I, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, had a number of discussions about Measure 5 and the outcomes of Measure 5 and how that process went. And he agreed to explore the need for a mechanism just like this, a governance council, to allow us to have discussions internal to intergovernmental functions of the major systems that we both shared. We met for the remainder of that year, the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, And the majority and minority leader in both houses, and the governor's representative, a representative of cities and a representative of counties, met for that year. We were staffed by Drew Hagedorn and looked at what other states had done. Was this a unique idea, or did other states have something like this, and why? At the end of that year, his term was over, and the whole legislature changed, and the idea was dropped, and it didn't come back again. What I think...
Well, before you move on, though,
yes.
I want to know, what did you learn in that year about other states? Do other states have this kind of a model?
Yes, they do, and we can give you that information.
Okay.
In fact, we talked to some of them. I had contact with them over the phone. Staff, Drew Hagedorn, had a number of conversations with their staff. The states of Connecticut, Florida, Indiana, Louisiana, Idaho, I'm sorry, Iowa, North Dakota, and Tennessee, and Utah, all have a body that's similar to this. They all do kind of different things, but the focus is generally the same, to have a continuum, a place where as legislators come and go, city mayors and councilors come and go, county commissioners come and go, there is a continuum. There's a place where you can come to talk about the nuts and bolts of governance. You don't get into advocacy at all. That's not what this is about. At least that's not, you know, what we're proposing here, and that was not what the group in 2001 discussed at all. There was a recognition that Measure 5 had made a major systems change, and that there really hadn't been a good way, no vehicle, to be able to get at the functioning, the nuts and bolts structure of how that system, the assessment taxation system in this state worked. And that was the genesis of that whole discussion, a recognition of that. And trying to find, they were trying to take the time in those months to try to figure out if Oregon was going to do it, looking at other states, how would it work best in Oregon if we were to do it? Well, as I said, at the end of that year, everything changed. Since then, we've had other systems failures. And when I say failure, what I mean is in terms of how it's structured, how it functions. In 1145, we had a corrections function failure in that system, and the legislature had to step in and try to deal with that. Measure 37 is a land use major systems failure now. It's being restructured. You have to deal with that in that system. PL 106, which has been referred to here, is a huge driving change that's significant across systems. It is going to interact on all of those systems together in different ways, and it's going to take time for that to fall, for that fallout to come about, for us to understand how those interconnections and how those failures are going to happen. And it will cross this year, next year, and the following year. So the reason for having a governance council isn't to create another level of government, but to have a vehicle for those levels of government to come together to discuss the structures and how those changes might occur in a way that you minimize as much as possible those unintended consequences that might otherwise occur. So that is why this proposal has come back here. Now, one of the things that happened in 2001 and I see starting to happen again here now is because there really isn't a good understanding of what this vehicle could do, and it doesn't necessarily have to even meet all the time. I see that it will meet when you have this need, that a lot of people want to come to the table, and they want to be involved in this. And I certainly understand that. But as proposed, it is nothing more than a place where the mechanics can come. Those with authority and responsibility for the systems can come and try to figure out where did it break, what's happening, and how do we fix it. this is not a body that can set laws or do anything else. This is an ongoing structural governmental entity, a place, a mechanism where they can come and they can do this work. Across, when you sit, when your membership changes, when our membership changes, so that you can keep that continuum and you don't constantly lose it. You don't continuously lose what you've learned. So that is our proposal. And we feel that we really need it desperately because as PL 106 plays out, and as we begin to see what happens to the Oregon transportation system, and I don't mean ODOT, I mean the entire system, the interconnected city, county, state system, I can foresee that that is going to be another system that you could have a failure in. We haven't had a gas tax increase in 16 years. We have done major things, taking care of the bridges.
Well, we did have one. It just failed 89 to 11 when the people voted on it. That was 1999.
Oh, I thought it was only 88 to 12, but...
Oh, I guess it was my district. It was 89 to 11.
I knew we had one on the ballot in recent memory.
A lot harder in my district than you did in yours.
So even though we have done Connect Oregon and we have had the OTAs, we haven't had anything that actually takes care of the potholes. And that's going to catch up with us somewhere along the line. And the loss of the timber revenues for the county system is going to have a major impact. So I can see we're going to have another failure out there in a major system. Mm-hmm. So I think it makes it even more important for us to get some vehicle in place.
And we're going to have a failure nationally in the transportation system. So, I mean, we need to work together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions, Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe this is good legislation, and I'm supporting it. It may be misnamed in terms of a governance council, because that implies your first reaction, Madam Chair, is this just another layer of government?
That's the biggest hurdle I see, is to get over that description.
We can name it.
Yes, you can name it. But then there's another hurdle we're going to hear about shortly, though. So.
Well, it's really focused on intergovernmental solutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the truth be known, we have not rationalized Measure 5 yet in this state. We're still coming to grips with that issue. And, you know, having served on Ways and Means and gone through the 03 and then the 05 session, in many ways leaving our partners somewhat stranded, partly stranded, including the not-for-profits and local units of government in pulling funding away, but yet leaving the policies in place in terms of continuing to provide services. I think this forum, it's really a solutions-driven forum, and I believe it's worthy of our support.
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Westland.
Now, when you see this distinguished array of political diversity in front of us, and to be more specific, when you see Leslie Lewis calling for help and in creating a mechanism to help local governments deal more effectively and articulate the problems that so plague us all, I don't think we can in any way be labeled or that this effort should be castigated as a mere creation of another layer of bureaucracy. There is a great deal of political wisdom and experience sitting in front of us, and they are speaking with one voice to help craft a better articulation and a methodology to solve real problems facing real Oregonians. It's that simple to me. I'm very supportive of this effort, and I thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Senator. I was looking at the staff measure summary that our administrator so ably prepared, and I had forgotten this bill was in front of my general government committee last session that I served on. It was Senate Bill 969. It was referred with a do-pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Senator George, myself, and Senator Shields supported it, and Senator Starr and Verger voted no. And there was a work session, and it was referred without recommendation, and that's where it sat. So I'm going to have to pull out my note files from 05, which means I'm going to have to send my staff over to some shed, some dark shed, and pull these out, because apparently these note files from last session are not stored in archives. But I need to do that, and then we need to hear from the labor community who've expressed some dislike about the bill and before we move forward. But I do appreciate your comments and your coming forward today. And you're a long drive from Condon. And
not the way she gets it. It's a long drive. It's just fast.
Shh. Don't tell anyone those secrets. All right. Thank you, ladies.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Your shed is no longer dark. It's got those old halide lights in there. And the school district sold them to your mini storage.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not sure where they are. I had to get some notes for a judiciary bill a couple of weeks ago, and my staff told me it's kind of a strange little place where they have to go to get it. Okay, we're going to hear from Duke Shepherd and Mary Bodkin, and then Gary Hansen, you're not signed up. Did you want to talk today, maybe after the two labor folks? Maybe you want to do a response, so to speak? We'd like to hear from you. So we'll hear from these good folks first. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Walker, members of the committee. For the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Sorry I don't have written testimony on this, and I'll be as brief as possible. I would just say my first reaction, having worked in both state and local government, was confusion when I saw this bill, that it seems to create a new body of government made up of government, appointed by government, to talk about government. And I've never observed legislators who weren't responsive to their local governments. That doesn't mean when I worked in local government, the legislature always did what we wanted, but I have not found a legislator in this building who wasn't responsive. This bill and the case I've heard today, and this is going to sound a little harsh, but it seems more to make a case against the effectiveness of associations for local governments than for a new board. Because when I look at all the Section 3 work, that's what taxpayers are paying for now when they pay for local governments and their associations. And so we're creating a body to do that work. It seems you ought to have one or the other, either a government-sanctioned body to convene and solve problems, or you should have associations. But paying twice for the same work product and the same people to do it seems not a particularly square deal for the taxpayer. And then just the straight-out labor case that I would make to you is that this would establish a very prestigious and high-level body that would produce recommendations for the legislature that would have extra force. It would come out, this report, it might be about nuts and bolts, but nuts and bolts become advocacy as soon as they call for change. And we would, frankly, be concerned about issues having to do with collective bargaining, about reductions or elimination of prevailing wage, and the kinds of issues that we wrestle with here in this building each session. And the committee may want to consider, if this bill advances, limitations on the subjects under consideration by this body, as is the case in collective bargaining, where some subjects can be talked about and some can't. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Bodkin, you didn't mark if you're for or against.
That's not by accident.
She does that. So you keep your guessing, see what she wants
I
to say.
I keep my powder dry.
Uh-huh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin, and I represent the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm here today to represent the victims of the decisions that will be made by the people who were here just previously to me. And I say that because right now our members sort of feel like they're on speed dial when money's needed for a campaign and the number's lost when a decision is being made about what happens to them. We represent the folks who were there for 30 years, You know, we represent the people who are there all day, every day, working for the citizens of Oregon. One thing that occurred to me as I was listening to this was, you know, there was a failed effort in Indianapolis, Indiana. It was called Reinventing Government. And the governor decided that what he would do is he would reinvent the city of Indianapolis without the workforce. What he found was, in order to reinvent government, he needed the workers to tell him what the problems were. Because when he met with the management team that he depended on, they blamed each other and they blamed the workers. And when he met with the workers, he found that they could identify problems and solutions. You know what? Mary Botkin does not need to sit on this council. But I would suggest, respectfully, that there are people who go to work every day who understand the problems that government faces more than any of the elected officials do, because they're the ones who crawl behind the steering wheels of the trucks, the ones who sit down in front of the computer terminals. They're the ones who know why they don't work. They know why their system is failing. And they know it from a practical side. Now, you know, we've heard a lot of talk about timber and PL 103 or 106. I just want to say that I was on the committee that went back to D.C. with ONC Timber and met with President Clinton to put the original package together. It was through the efforts of special districts, local governments, and labor that President Clinton and Al Gore put together the package that replaced the dollars to begin with. It was our best efforts. But, you know, I guess, you know, I think we do better work together than we do separately. But constantly this session, I have been reminded that the local governments that we represent don't see us as partners. And they see us as advocates when they need us and unwanted stepchildren when they don't. And, you know, I would just like to make the case that we're either partners all the time or we're not partners any of the time. And partnerships need to be kept together, not used and then kicked to the curb. I found, you know, the comments about they need the mechanics at the table, nobody else. I would suggest that we represent the mechanics. They represent the people who bought the truck. We keep it running. And our members need to have a voice. And the timber issue, the funding issues, all of these issues, our members, the 20,000 people that we represent, and I've handed you a list of all the counties we represent. We represent nearly every county that will be impacted by a loss of these timber dollars.
Okay. Senator Morris has a question.
Well, actually, I'm ready to ask for an amendment.
You're ready to ask for the amendment to this bill, the emergency clause?
No, I'm asked for a new amendment.
A new amendment, which
is? -2.
Which is?
I didn't mean to interrupt your...
No, you're fine.
But you would have continued anyway.
I believe, given the testimony and given, you know, the need for this to be a holistic approach, that a -2 amendment would be very appropriate, that would add 2 members to this council, or what are we calling it? Is it a council?
Governance council.
And those 2 members would represent labor and would be appointed by the governor.
Okay. That's a suggestion and a question to the two of you.
Senator Walker, Senator Morris, it sounds good. I would need to run it by people who are on my board, but we generally like being included in things, so we really appreciate your thought there, Senator Morris.
Senator Walker, Senator Morris, of course, we appreciate that, and I would have to talk to my executive director, but, you know, certainly that would go some distance in solving the problem that we have with this rather high-level board. And I do think that, as you know, Senator Morse, we've worked with you a lot over the years. And I just, you know, I sort of want to remind people, ballot measure 5, it was the education community and the rest of the labor community that came together, both private and public sector unions, who stepped up and funded that campaign. You know, our members made a monthly commitment to make sure that there was money available to fight these horrible, horrible ballot measures that devastated Oregon. Ballot measure 11, ballot measure 50, ballot measure 5, ballot measure 37.
41 and 48.
41 and 48. You know, we are the ones who made the phone calls. We knocked on the doors. And I just, you know, I feel very passionately about defending the work that my members may do and the commitment, financial commitment that they make out of their paychecks every month to fund these programs so that we can beat back more of these measures and not pass them. They wouldn't even be here today if some of these measures had passed that we were able to defeat. And we've learned our lesson about putting our differences aside and working together. I'm not sure our elected officials have learned that yet.
Well, I don't know that I want to go there, but...
I'm not speaking about the panel by any means.
Okay. All right. Well, Senator Morse has made a suggestion, so yeah. I would recommend that you talk to folks, that you all talk to each other. Any other questions of this panel? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gary Hansen. I'm a former state representative from Portland. I've just been passed a note that, and I'll speak to a couple issues that have came up. I really wasn't prepared to testify. The Governmental Solutions Council might be a possible amendment in terms of creating a more workable name. My first public office was as a Metro Councilor in the 80s. I was the County Commissioner in the 90s and served in the legislature up until last session. All the way through my career, I've noticed seen a disconnect sometimes between the different units of government and how they come together to solve common solutions. I can assure you from 24 years experience, this council is badly needed. I wish we had had it 24 years ago because we could have anticipated some other problems. The most pressing problem I see now, of course, is with the decline of the timber revenues. I served on the Multnomah County Commission when Measure 5 passed, and we had to make cuts of about 12% of our general fund. It was incredibly painful. As it turned out, because of rising tax revenues, we didn't have to go that deep. But I remember struggling for 6 months with where we were going to put those cuts. Now when I see Douglas County, Josephine County, Curry County, looking at 70% reductions and more to the general fund. I can't imagine how those local officials could deal with that type of a crisis. Even some of our larger counties, Lane County, is facing, I think it's a 34% cut. Benton County, 15%. These are significant, significant interruptions to public service. There's just no way to avoid that. If we get a reprieve from the federal government with a ramp down over a five-year period, we need this council working and coming up with solutions now, because the solutions may take either multiple legislative sessions, they may take constitutional amendments, they may, it's going to be a long, involved process if we're fortunate enough to have the five-year reprieve. That, coupled with a council like this that can start dealing with solutions at the end of that period, is vital. We've had some discussions today concerning lack of inclusion of organized labor, and certainly Senator Morris's proposed amendments could deal with that. I think we could set sideboards to keep this out of labor management issues. It's not about PERS. It's not about collective bargaining. It's about structure of government. And I know we'd be very willing to move in that direction. I certainly welcome the opportunity to work on developing amendments that can meet those concerns.
Okay, that sounds fair. I'll just ask you to talk with labor a little bit about that. And I did run this by one of my county commissioners right after the proposal came to me, and they weren't too, that person wasn't too keen on this, so I'm going to run it back down the flagpole to my county commissioners and see what they're doing. I think one of mine is president of the
AOC
this year.
Bobby Green.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't him that I spoke to. Okay, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was prepared to offer a third dash three, or a third amendment. But I see, as pointed out by Senator Metzger, the relating clause is probably too narrow to change the name at this point.
Yeah, the committee administrator did point that out to me as well, because of Senator Metzger's keen eye.
But we might have other vehicles broader that we could use.
Yeah. All right, well, I have to get my notes and see why I voted yes last session. Okay, any other comments? And I appreciate all the comments we've had today and participation by the members here. Anything else? Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill, what were we on, 775. And I think that's all we have. Colleagues, remember that we start at 8 a.m. Starting next week, because we've been told to close down our committees at 10 a.m. for the new floor session. So please try to be on time. I know that's a little bit earlier than we're used to.
Madam Chair, it is not as early as 7:15.
Our other committee.
Other committee that Senator Metzger and I are on.
Oh, my. You moaned about 8 o'clock. You
I'm here at 6, but, you know, that's the only time you have meetings is between 6 and 8. So.
I know.
Madam Chair, I was here at 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, one time. One doggone time.
I saw you on the TV.
The first and last.
All right. For the good of the order, we're done with that discussion. We'll adjourn. Thank you.